Well, as kind of the as the years are going by and you are beginning to see the significance of the work and they are starting to get awards and recognition outside of their labs for the work that they're doing and you are doing, how did this change your own perspective on the significance and the contributions of your own, of your work in that lab?
Well, as the years went by, the lab grew.
Right.
So there were a lot of people making contributions. And I was just one of those. So I realized that and appreciated the fact that my contributions were moving this project forward, were helping us understand more about whatever it was that we were studying at that time. I mean, just the whole idea of receptor-mediated endocytosis and intracellular cholesterol metabolism. But I also realized that, you know, I was just a small part of it, and that there were other people pulling their weight and making contributions, and we all kind of came together to move the wagon forward. So it wasn't that one of us was doing it. We were all doing it. And each one sort of substantiated the other, or corroborated, or contributed to the general acceptance. So each individual member of the research group was providing data that contributed to the general acceptance and the understanding of the facts that we were discovering.
Well, you do make key contributions. You do get several first author papers out of their lab, and if I understand it right, you develop an assay to measure cholesterol within cells.
Mm-hmm.
And so you are functioning independently. And why, given that as time is going on, their lab size is increasing, the excitement's increasing, and I'm sure the competition is increasing, and why is it that you are able to make these contributions in a very productive and growing lab?
Well, I liked it. I mean, it was really a lot of fun learning. You know, it was sort of the, you know, I guess fulfilling dreams that being part of this group, that with each week or month or year became more more productive. And, you know, I realized that I was just extremely lucky to be there. I could be at Wadley or Miller Brewery, whatever. But, and I may have been happy there. But to actually get up in the morning and enjoy going to work because of what potential opportunity or potential thing I might learn that day or result that might come up that could help us. And was a real motivation to get up early, get to work, walk quickly from the garage to the lab, and stay late, and come in on the weekends. And then everybody else was doing it. I mean, there weren't any exceptions. Joe and Mike were there on the weekends, all the postdocs. So it was sort of like a train going downhill, that the momentum it went faster and faster and faster, and you didn't want to get off. Now, that wasn't all that always fun. I mean, there were some downsides. There were some personality conflicts and some raw times, but I think any time you have people working together closely and and have common goals, and there's going to be disputes about how to approach those goals, or egos get in the way. And
right.
So I think I was somewhat removed from that because I wasn't in any kind of competition with anybody. I mean, I was at that time, I was, you know, working my way up through the technician and associate rank. So I had a stable job. I wasn't like a postdoc that was going to have to get X number of papers and so much credentials in order to go off and to their next position, to the next level. So I don't think that I had the same or experienced those sort of competition and sensitivity to egos that, say, postdocs did. And then also my interactions with Joe and Mike were a little bit, my relationship with them was a little bit different than, say, the postdocs, which by that time had become the lion's share of the labs. There were just, well, Gloria's still there. She's the technician. She's still there. And there are other technicians, but the numbers increased primarily, I think, due to a flux of postdocs that become rotating, coming through. So, you know, I didn't have the same sort of relationship that they had with Joe and Mike. And sometimes that was good and sometimes it was bad because they also had pressures to see to it that their postdocs had a good measure of success. Otherwise, they wouldn't be getting good postdocs. You know, you have this track record of turning out, bringing in postdocs and having them be successful and accomplished and productive so that they'll go off and get good jobs so that you can bring in another batch. Whereas, you know, Faust, he's going to be here for a while. but they rewarded me amply.
Yeah.
And it was not, well, I didn't make a whole lot of money. I used to get aggravated. I mean, the University of Texas never did pay very much. And I sure wish I got paid more. You know, that was a sore thumb every time raises came up. I think I rubbed Joe, because he would always be the one that would tell us, you know, what next year's salary is going to be. And you took that out on him.
Well, I know in the humanities, the University of Texas pays better than the University of California.
Now. Really?
Yeah. I don't know if that says speaks better to University of Texas or speaks down.
Well, I don't know what the
California.
I don't know what the technicians what to pay now, but my starting salary when I started in 1974 was $748 a month, and that was, and then you have to deduct whether it was Social Security and teacher retirement was like 6.8%. That was a real letdown. And it didn't. And then for a long time, especially in the late 70s when oil wasn't doing so well, there wasn't hardly any cost of living raises, so it didn't go up that much. Anyway, but I mean, I didn't, money's, what are you going to do with money? I didn't have a whole lot of response. I don't have any children, you know, so it doesn't make any difference. What do you make? As long as you're comfortable.
Well, were you still able to have your horses and everything, given all the time you're spending in the lab?
Well, no, I think we left DeSoto. We were living in DeSoto on this acreage and decided we'd buy a house. So Kathy and I moved into Garland and bought a house. And that's Garland's a suburb, so into suburbia. And and lived there for several years, and then she and I parted ways. And I mean, she still lived in Dallas. I mean, so I think she still lived in Garland, or so. I moved back into Dallas and continued to work there. So I kind of, that was my last experiences with more of a rural setting.
And how was it to work with it? She was working in Goldstein's lab.
No, it wasn't Goldstein's lab. She worked at a cytogenetics lab associated with children's. But they performed karyotypic analysis that was used in the genetic counseling clinics. So that was the interaction.
Okay, so it wasn't like you were working together.
No. And then I think at that point, So she didn't actually, I think she stopped working at Children's and transferred and then began working at, where did she go to? She changed jobs. I can't remember, but I think she didn't work much longer at Children's. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, where did you see yourself fitting into the lab in terms of kind of the social hierarchies that developed and educational hierarchies that developed in laboratories?
Well, I thought that they treated me just like a postdoc in terms of educational opportunities, and which was great because, you know, I wasn't, but I was being treated like one. Probably getting paid more too, I guess, by that time, because postdocs don't make all. In the social structure, then I wasn't at the same level as a postdoc. And, you know, if a visitor would come to town and they would be to go out to dinner, then, you know, I didn't go. I didn't go to meetings much. I think it was hard to get money to send technicians on meetings, you know, at least that's what I was told. But that really didn't bother me. And going out to eat with the seminar speaker really didn't bother me. Or not doing those things didn't bother me all that much. So it was a good position to be in, to be treated like something that you obviously aren't qualified, or on paper you weren't qualified to do, but yet, and we're given the freedom, the same sort of freedom as that those people in that position, and have the respect from not only the people who are supervising you, but the people in that position, because all the postdocs who came respected me as if I was one of their peers. Was an enviable position, as long as you didn't have a big ego, which I never had.
Well, how did you see your own abilities in comparison to these postdocs that perhaps went to meetings and met the important people?
Yeah. Well, initially I thought that my abilities were on par, right, after I kind of got up to speed with what was going on in the project and in the field. But then the caliber of postdocs got better that came. As they became more popular, they attracted a much higher caliber postdoc. And then with each new year, then students who had finished their PhDs were much more skillful with new contemporary techniques and ideas. So you have, not only do you have the basic, I guess not only is the caliber of postdocs coming better, but just in general, the postdoc world is much more skillful. With time, you know, my skills and knowledge background were inferior, especially on a lot of broadly associated fields of biology associated with the things that we were doing in the lab. But that was okay because that gave me an opportunity to learn from them, the postdocs that came, about what their skills were that they were bringing to the project. Because Joe and Mike would try to attract postdocs, as they did for me, that could help them accomplish initially a specific goal or project. So if they wanted, when they first set out to clone genes, they brought in a fellow who had just cloned, or who had worked in a very prominent cloning lab. Their first faculty hire, when they first started the Department of Molecular Genetics, a full-fledged department, there was only a faculty of two. Joe was the chairman, and Mike was full professor. And then they said, okay, we're going to hire somebody. So who do you think they hired first? What field do you think they filled first? They went here to Boston, to E.J. Corey's lab over at Harvard University, great synthetic chemist, and hired his best postdoc because they wanted to do some really good, sophisticated chemistry Well, orders of magnitude above what I'd done by just synthesizing cholesterol esters. And so here's Camille Falk, who the only thing he ever used a biology book for was to set his coffee cup on, was now the first faculty hire in the Department of Medical Genetics at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical School, because that was a need that they had to have in their department for this knowledge and these skills. So then they hired postdocs that way too. Now, I'm not sure that that was the only criteria. I think coming, you know, their project and their knowledge and how quick-witted they were or whatever was important. But if they could bring skills to our group that we didn't have, that was a real plus.
And what did that tell you about your own skills and background, chemistry background, at looking at kind of your own opportunities?
Are you saying that did I feel like I was being phased out or something?
No. Just in terms of that, it made an impression that the first hire was a chemist.
Right.
Right. What did that then say to you about your own potential and opportunities about with your background and your interests in chemistry and biochemistry?
Well, I guess not much, because at that time it was, you know, I'd kind of phased out any, or I had consumed all or expounded all the skills that I had that they didn't have and used them, so where they knew what they were, and the project had progressed to the point that we were beyond the point that I could have anything, that I was bringing anything unique to the table. So, but I thought it said a lot for how they approach, you know, research, in that to try and not necessarily try to avoid surrounding yourself with your peers who have more or less the same skills and technology that you have, but instead, albeit it's somewhat of a gamble, to bring in perhaps individuals who it might be difficult for you to not manage, but oversee, or to be critical in a positive and negative sense about their performance if you really don't understand or have a good grasp of the experiments that they're doing and the type of work they're doing. But yet they could challenge themselves to educate, to bring themselves to that same level of this new postdoc, to grow along with the rest of us if we had an they had the same opportunity that the rest of us did. Probably did a much better job of it. And you can see also that when new postdocs would come in, then and have newly acquired skills or traits or technology, then it was important. I could see that it was important that all of us learn from these people. And that wasn't always the case with other people. For instance, if Frank Smith was an electron microscopist and he started to work in Joe's group or in our group because they were interested in studying gold labeling of LDL and its metabolism in cells, then maybe Mary Doe didn't see that as an opportunity to learn about electron microscopy and what you could do with it to study a complex cell biological pathway. And that's not a bad thing, because Mary's got other things that she's worried about. But it says something about people that I think reached a level where they think that they don't want to learn anymore or want to begin to focus specifically on their own project and not try to acquire information from the outside or on the side or from the periphery to bring it into their project. It's not that they're sticking their head in the sand, but they're just not keeping their eyes wide open. So I thought that was a trait that I should avoid. You know, that I should at all costs try to learn from everybody who came into the labs.
Well, was Nobel Prize ever whispered
Oh, yeah.
around?
Oh, yeah.
At what point did it become clear that this work was of major significance?
Well, I think back in the early 80s, because I think first time I heard it was that they had won sufficient number of these prizes that they were on a track. And I don't know the names. I think Lasker is one of them. National Academy, that they were just on the right path for a Nobel Prize. And a lot of other people in the school, you know, began to joke about it and saying, oh, well, someday, when they get the Nobel Prize, you know, there won't be hats big enough to fit their heads and this kind of stuff, so.
Well, why do you decide to leave their lab?
Well, I think, no, I was thinking about that. I've always thought about this. And I think that some of, I guess there are probably three reasons. One is that the politics, my perception is that the politics in the lab began to change. There was, maybe it was just that set of people that were there in before I left, but there seemed to be a lot more friction and a lot more pettiness. Competition between postdocs was for attention and resources and their attention, their resources was pretty high. And then that caused, I think, contributed to friction and a little bit of pettiness. And so I guess I thought, well, that's probably going to get worse before it gets better, because it may be just a normal consequence of getting to these levels in science. And I just didn't like to be a part of that. I didn't like to watch it at all. And then I began to realize that I thought that it might be nice to do some of this on my own, you know, to at least give it a try. And although Joe and Mike had both encouraged me to apply to a PhD program there at Southwestern and to go back to school and what all, that just didn't seem like a keen idea. I guess I was just lazy. And I enjoyed working in the lab, didn't want to go back in the classroom. So, but there were, because the things that we were doing in cholesterol metabolism had such important implications pharmacologically, then I knew that there were pharmaceutical houses that would find a place for somebody like me with the experience, the years of experience I had in their lab. You know, for instance, they I think were what's the term? They traveled to Merck quite a bit and consulted. They were consultants at Merck. And this was back when Merck was trying to develop Mevacor, or lovastatin. So, you know, and they'd come back a couple of times and say, oh, you could go here and do these things in these labs and get paid lots of money and be a principal investigator, albeit in a pharmaceutical house, but still a research-type job. So that kind of was appealing. You know, even though I'd leave this environment that has nurtured me and allowed me to grow, it'd be a meaningful challenge to see if I could do similar things on my own, albeit at not the level or the striking force that they could, but just to determine whether I could survive. So that was nice. And then, lastly, I began to get the impression, and I'm sure that, you know, that they may think otherwise, that they could see, they were beginning to see me in a more limited capacity, like towards setting up the placing me in just a specialized arena within the lab. For instance, being in charge of a sequencing laboratory or a recombinant DNA laboratory. That was more routine type work and not, you know, pursuit of anything directly informative, a direct investigation. And now I perceived that that was their ambitions for me. And like I said, I think that they'll say that was not true. But nevertheless, it was my perception. And I just didn't want to get into that sort of position. I still wanted to be challenged in the same fashion that I was being challenged for the past 10 or 11 years, and not to be challenged with, say, just technology. So I began to look for a job.
And was Goldstein and Brown aware of these changes in politics? You know, what was their role in the kind of how does the gradual evolution of things in their lab?
Well, I'm sure they were, but I never discussed it with them. I mean, I didn't think it was my place. I mean, I was sort of like a fly on the wall lots of times. And I really was never involved in any conflicts or challenges. They certainly had to confront those and deal with them. I don't think that, you know, they thought anything more about it with respect to my attitude or like. You know, I'm sure that I'm not. That these sort of things happen in all labs. In fact, I see it all the time here, I mean, especially in big labs. And it's not anything unique to their situation or speaks poorly to their management skills or whatever. It's just that it's the natural consequence of things when you get to that large scale of operation and with so many people that realize there's, as I did so long ago, that there was a real opportunity here, that you try to want to do the best you can, and sometimes that occasionally oversteps the point at which right kind of drifts into wrong, or good sense drifts into misjudgment.
And where did you see the issue that you didn't have a PhD fitting in to what was happening to, you know, in the lab and what was driving your decisions to leave the lab?
Well, I think not having a PhD was maybe influencing Joe and Mike to think about putting me in these other types of positions or other roles in the lab. And I think that, and then also that these roles came about. I mean, it's clear that they had to have someone who run, because they were going to do a lot of protein sequencing. So they need to have somebody to do that. They need to have someone reliable to do it. And they needed to have people that could make monoclonal antibodies. They need to have their whole lab do that. And they took a postdoc, a very skillful postdoc, and put him in charge of just making antibodies. So they need to have these services within their department that the rest of us would go out and pay for. So the fact that I didn't have a PhD just kind of fit that mold a little bit better. I didn't think lacking a PhD was going to hurt me in looking initially for the jobs that I was interested in, like at Merck or at Upjohn. So I interviewed both those places. Because biotech didn't have to follow the same guidelines that an academic institution did with respect to doctorates. Mainly because you have to have a doctorate to get funding from any extramural source. That's because you have to be a faculty member. And Tufts is not going to make anybody less than a PhD a faculty member. So that means that if you don't have a PhD, you're not going to get funding. Well, that doesn't wash in industry because you don't apply for grants. There, you just, whoever you can, whoever's your supervisor and his supervisor is who you have to convince to give you money. And it doesn't make a difference as long as you're productive and you've got some history that you can point to and say, you know, this is what I've done, and this is these are my ideas, and this is what I want to do. And there's nothing about diplomas in there. So I thought that at least on the outset, the jobs that I was interested in didn't need to have a PhD. They just need to have the skills and the history and the references that I had.
And why industry as opposed to maybe a strictly research institute or perhaps another a smaller lab where you could have independence?
Well, then again, I mean, if it was a research institute, in order for me to be completely independent or have some measure of independence, I'd have to get my own funding. And I couldn't do that myself without a PhD. Now, I could perhaps piggybacking along another principal investigator, but that didn't seem as desirable as whatever. And then identifying somebody like that could be troublesome. Getting along with somebody like that may or may not be feasible, may or may not cause problems. And working in a smaller lab, if I thought if I was going to change, make that kind of change, then it was going to be not to the same situation, if I understand you correctly, is by going to a smaller lab, it would be just more or less the same sort of situation, trying to learn or learning and another research topic just in another environment. It wasn't anything new to me, except maybe the project. But going and being a principal investigator myself, that was new. And that was worth the change. Or to try to do that would be worth the change. I mean, picking up and moving, too, which I really didn't. I never really thought about moving away from Texas until about that time. And I don't know, you just mature. And it wasn't that anything was pushing me out. I guess it was just time to do something else. Or time to accept the fact that moving is okay. Whereas, you know, in the years prior to that, I'd say, well, I'd never leave, you know. And my family was all there and friends.
And why did you choose then to go to DuPont?
Well, DuPont had a wonderful initiative started. They had made bukus of money in chemistry, and rightly so. I mean, they were enormous profit from their chemical technology, and they were setting up a life science program to branch out into biology, and more or less kind of the groundwork for a biotechnology company. Maybe even, I don't know, far-reaching blueprints would be a pharmaceutical company. And as part of this, in this initiative's first step was to just try and set up an institution within DuPont, similar to, say, like the Roche Institute that Hoffman and Roche set up, that was kind of freestanding, funded by DuPont's money, to bring in qualified and exceptional scientists to just do research, and to do this at their what's called their experimental station outside of Wilmington, Delaware, which is really a campus atmosphere. So there's all these wonderful old buildings that are with fully equipped, well-equipped, modern chemical laboratories in which the bulk of DuPont's technological research is performed in these laboratories. And it had been that way since the turn of the century, too. So there was this environment that was already set up to do basic research, and a huge library, plenty of resources. So they were just going to build a new building and say, all right, this is going to be, we're going to do the same sort of thing with biology. And then lo and behold, I'm sure that there's going to be knowledge or information or spin-offs that's going to come out of this biology building as a result of this research that we might be able to seize upon in our more applied senses, but we'll have a head start on it because it was started here in our life science programs. So this was sort of like a purely basic research institute, but not all by itself. It was part of a large complex of other supportive systems. It really seemed like an ideal situation. I can't tell you how exciting it was just to realize that they were starting this, and on paper it was going to be the paradise. You know, no, you didn't have to apply for extramural funding. And for somebody like me, you know, great. And it happened to be that one of the projects, so they were targeting three areas, immunology, membrane biology and cholesterol metabolism, and neurosciences. And so one of them happened to be something that, you know, I had a good stance in. And then secondly, the leader of the group, Jim Gaylor, was very prominent in cholesterol metabolism. So he was familiar with me and my work, although I didn't know him. So that was certainly an inside track. So it was just a perfect setup to go and begin to work there. Didn't more or less, well, I didn't do any of the things I didn't take anything with me from Dallas in terms of projects, but just began to study what I wanted to study in the context of other avenues in cholesterol metabolism in a brand new building, brand new laboratories, plenty of money, more salary than I make now. This was, what, 12 years ago? And it was, so even though Merck had made a job offer, it was still more or less being part of a group that was focusing on pharmaceuticals related to cholesterol metabolism. And so it was drug hunting. And, you know, that was okay. About half the time was that, and the other half would be something else. Upjohn's had a comparable offer, but nothing as potentially spectacular as what DuPont was proposing. And what they did, and later I discovered that they weren't able to follow through on it, you know, so on paper it was great. I think Joe actually went there. So they actually opened the building before I went, and then he was actually part of the opening day ceremony or something, a keynote speaker. And I think that speaks for, at that time, the commitment that DuPont had to really project this enterprise into what they hoped would be a Roach Institute within the confines of DuPont de Nemours.
Yeah. Well, how committed were you when you left the lab, the Goldstein Brown lab, that to continue research in the cholesterol metabolism field?
Absolutely. I think that I had plenty of ideas that I thought that, you know, that I could do my little niche over here that would not be related directly to what they were doing, and so therefore would be in competition. It was clear that you couldn't be in competition with them. I was just anxious to get started. I thought that there was a great opportunity for me to test my mettle.
Well, had the Nobel Prize been announced when you left?
No, they waited until I left.
Yeah.
So I left in January, and then that was announced in that fall.
Yeah.
I joke with them about, well, the Nobel Committee waited for me to leave.
Really? Well, how did that kind of change the way you saw your decisions, or did that influence how you subsequently felt about leaving the lab?
Well, I don't think it made me regret leaving any more or less, or it made me glad I left any more or less. I understand there was a big party down there. I think I taped their acceptance speech and played it back or something. I didn't see it live or whatever for some reason or another.
And I was glad they won. There was, you know, I kind of,
so I don't think you, I think Joe pointed this out one time. You, really, in the truest sense, you shouldn't say that people win these kind of prizes. That's not the right verb. They're awarded. But, I mean, there is competition for it. So, but I think that, and I just used it. So, but, I think that they deserve to be awarded the Nobel Prize. And, at this rate, I think they probably should get another one. Not today, but if they continue to be as productive, then they probably serve another one for their efforts in science and medicine. So I was certainly glad, and I was glad I was part of that. They sent me a nice silver platter, beautiful thing. I have to polish in order to keep it. I have to polish it like once every 6 months just to keep it sparkling, but it's something that I have that, I can point to and say that, this was my contribution. Now, this shows that I contributed to history. And, I don't think there's other people around that has that pleasure. I mean, there are, but not as many. So, I'm glad that I have that platter, and I'm glad that they gave it to me. But I don't feel like, to get back to the original question, that I made a mistake in leaving, or that I should have left earlier. I think I left when the time was right.
Well, did that change, do you think, the state of Texas' attitude towards funding biomedical sciences?
Well,
I think that was the first Nobel Prize for a Texas institution.
That's correct. And which work was, there were several Nobel laureates that were at Texas institutions, a couple of them in chemistry at A&M, but they had done the work elsewhere. But that was the first homegrown prize, so to speak. And yes, that caught a lot of the attention of some prominent people in not only the government, but as well as philanthropic circles around Dallas. So I don't know if you're aware of it, Ross Perot is a major benefactor of Joe and Mike.
Really?
Yeah. Research. Well, and I'm sure that there's been a couple of meals thrown in there,
yeah,
too.
Plenty of money to do it. I didn't know.
But that's great for the medical center.
Yeah.
The medical center, I'm sure, even after I've left, has benefited enormously just from their presence there. Not only, like I said, attracting this. So Ross Perot essentially set up an MD-PhD program. Funds an MD-PhD program just at Southwestern. I think there's 20 MD-PhD students each year.
Does it have his name on it?
Probably.
Yeah.
I mean, we can talk about the pluses and minuses of Ross Perot. I'm sure that they, although Mike, I'm sure that they have their own, but Mike made some, I heard that at a national scientific meeting, he stood up and said that, asked the audience to support Perot in his quest for presidency in 92?
Two, right, yeah.
Which was, if that's true, then that certainly is out of place. It was almost like people were kidding. Well, was that like an endorsement that was paid for,
Qualifies as an advertisement.
But I don't know. But their presence certainly has improved the medical school. And then and the other thing, too, is that it's attracted this enormous caliber of faculty. I mean, Al Gilman, another Nobel laureate. Sandbrook was there, and I think he's leaving now. Just two numerous names for me to mention, just to bring these people in just because they were there. Which they view as a plus for them too, because if they wanted, and in fact they insisted that pharmacology, where Gilman went to, be right down the hall from them. So Al Gilman became a close associate in our and participant in our lab meetings, because he could bring some things to the table that we didn't have.